Moncrief on News Talk.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Joanna Fortune joins us once again for our parenting slot. Afternoon, Joanna.
Afternoon, Sean.
Right, here's your first question. I think my son is gay. I'm about 99.9% sure. I'm sure he knows how he feels, but is too nervous to talk about it. He's 16 years of age since January, and I've thought that this since he was around 10 or 11. We have never discussed it with him. I've talked to his father about it, and he doesn't want to hear it. He won't talk about it and tells me quite forcibly to be quiet when I bring it up. I just don't want my son thinking he can't talk to us, or at least me. What can I do to help my son, and as an extension, my husband too? Or perhaps maybe it's the other way around, Joanna.
Yeah, I just, with this one, I just think there's so much certainty expressed in here that I'm actually going to start by saying to you to step out of that place of certainty and hold a position of curiosity, that you are open to receiving anything your son might bring to you when and if he chooses to do that. We can't do this for our kids. We can't say, well, I know it. And look, on the maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. That's the whole point of staying out of certainty and holding a position of curiosity. Because if you exude this certainty about it, then what has he got to bring you that you don't already know? And I think that's really important here, that you don't force this. This is his journey. And what you can do is create an atmosphere at home of tolerance and acceptance, that you open communication, you know, ensure all topics can be openly spoken about. You can even draw on things that are represented in media, TV shows, articles, anything like that, that you ensure you express sensitive and supportive comments or views about anything to do with LGBTQ plus representation that you see or hear anywhere, and that you keep that kind of open, sensitive dialogue available and the door open. But please don't force anyone through it. You know, your son, your husband, that's not for you to do. I think you have to give a message that, you know, to him that you are a safe and supportive relationship. And it sounds like you're doing that, by the way, if and when he chooses to speak to you. Because I just think you don't want, just like you don't want to assume your husband is against this or, you know, opposed to this, it may be worth, you know, creating an open dialogue there about why does he want you to stop talking about it? Might it be that he'd rather wait for your son to bring this to you both?
Yeah.
And then actually he may be open and supportive. Is it that he doesn't want you forcing this prematurely? So again, holding a position of curiosity allows you to deepen your understanding of everybody's perspective and experience, but kind of plowing forward with a position of certainty is quite closed thinking, actually. Mm.
I'm guessing, though, if that was the reason that the dad didn't want to talk about it, the dad would have said that. She seems to be clearly implying that she's worrying that the father may be being in denial or is intolerant or whatever the reason is, that might be something preventing the son from expressing this.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that is the strong inference here. But again, it isn't explicitly stated. So again, I would just be curious with the dad going, you know, look, and again, have that conversation outside of home when you're together and can have an open conversation on a walk and say it's something you feel really strongly about, that your home is one of acceptance and tolerance, that you simply have that as the message and see what his response to that is. Mm-hmm. And again, that you just make sure that your son knows that he has an available, supportive, sensitive relationship that he can bring anything to.
Yes.
If, when he chooses it. He's still 16 years old. And, you know, that kind of journey about discovering who we are, how we are, what we want, what we like, our desire, all of that is an evolving process through adolescence. So when he's ready, I think he will bring this to you. And in the meantime, absolutely, there are lots of things that you can do, you know, making sure that, like, language is very careful at home, that you do promote LGBTQ relationships, platforms, the cause, that you are very, you know, clear in how you speak about things, that this is something that you would be very open to receiving and that you would be available to support. If you can do all of that, you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
In parenting and creating something that, you know, when he's ready. I feel very strongly it should be when your son is ready, that you don't you don't bring him somewhere he's not ready to go prematurely.
Yeah, indeed. Except this might involve going on yet another walk. Oh, God.
Yeah. I had to say walk. There wasn't a whole lot else we could do.
Yeah, I saw on Twitter the other day that someone tweeted about a little girl was on the phone to her grandfather and the father was saying, what are you doing today? And she said, Mammy says we're going on another effing walk.
Oh, I think we all relate to that.
except she didn't say effing. Right. I have two kids, 5 and 3, who love to scream. I know what you'll say, all kids do, but I can be sitting merely 2 feet away from them and they will shout at me, asking for a drink or a snack or to put on their favourite movie. I tell them not to shout, that I can hear them perfectly fine, but it doesn't work. They're just shouting their way through life at the minute. It's particularly embarrassing at the supermarket. Is there a knack to teaching them how to lower their voices?
God, I wish there was. I could retire on that.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, because you have 2 children, I'm less inclined to think this is the reason. But for anyone else going, gosh, that's me too. That's my child. Always ensure that your child's hearing is healthy when they're shouting and roaring at you. I just love to rule out physical things before we decide it's something emotional or behavioural. And there are a couple of playful things that you can do about co-regulation of sound and voice pitch. But just to kind of contextualise this, and, you know, I love that you say at the beginning, look, I know you're going to say all kids do this. You know, many kids do this, okay? Some kids don't. But the main reason those who do, that they use those loud voices, is excitement, you know, especially at this age. They feel things really deeply. So it's not that I'm, you know, happy about it. I'm thrilled to bits. You know, I'm not angry. I'm furious. I'm not sad. I'm devastated. Sometimes we have these feelings at these amplified too much levels, and excitement also falls into that. So when this age group in particular, but when they're really interested in something or really immersed in their play or really involved in an activity that's going on, their play, you know, the pitch that they're speaking at escalates with the energy of the play. So it's big and busy play. It's a big and busy voice that goes with it. And, you know, of course, and it's easy for me to say this because you have 2 of them shouting and roaring at you. That's quite different. But my instinct is, don't mute excitement. You know, there's a window of opportunity for children to really feel the world in that beautiful, unfiltered, pure childhood way. And excitement and the loudness and the crash bang wallop of everything that goes on is a key part of that. They don't yet have those, you know, enriched or enhanced communication skills that enable them to express with emotional fluency what's going on, what they're thinking, what they're feeling. It just crashes out of them like this, and some of them more than others. And you may have had 1 cheerleader of the loud voice and the sibling is mirroring what they're over.
Yeah.
Is doing, that can definitely happen. There's a couple of books that spring to mind about this. There's a nice one, not particular to your kids now, but again, if it's relevant to anyone, it is relevant to these kids, but I'm not saying that they interrupt or intrude. It's called My Mouth is a Volcano by Julia Cook. And it deals with loud voices or interrupting someone else speaking with your fabulous ideas. You know, when you've got a little child who they're just already 10 steps ahead with what they're going to say next. So they talk over you and they're not listening and not waiting. It's a nice little book, My Mouth is a Volcano. And a lovely one that I love to use in lots of ways at home myself, as well as in work, is one called How Are You Feeling Today by Molly Potter. And it has a lovely little index at the front where you find your feeling. It could be excited, sad, angry, whatever it is, frustrated, confused. And then it has a correlating page number. You say, well, that's my feeling. I go to page 14 and it has 6 or 8 practical things that I can do with that feeling to express it. So there are healthy ways of expressing your excitement, or things I can do when I feel sad, or things I can do. And it's really empowering of children to help build that emotional fluency. And yours are at a lovely age for doing that. Outside of that, I think you could definitely use a bit of what I'm going to call co-regulation play, but it's that match and mirror, match and regulate type of play. So when they're loud, meet them not quite as loud as they are, but maybe 10% below them, so that you're still reachable. And you could do that through the game I've mentioned here before, jelly and ice cream. Pick 2 foods they like. It could be, you know, chicken and chips, or, you know, broccoli and cauliflower, let's be optimistic. It could be anything at all they like to eat. And you say jelly, they say ice cream back. They're 5 and 3. Don't worry about accuracy. If they say jelly as well, it doesn't matter. It's not a game of accuracy. It's about matching. But you start loud, shouting jelly, they shout ice cream. You bring it way down to a whisper, they whisper. You bring it back up, but not quite as loud, back down, but not quite as low, and you settle somewhere in the middle. So you're doing an activity that actually shows them the tone that you want to hear without telling them, stop shouting, don't do this, because that's not going in. Their excited little brains aren't taking in your verbal cues. It's much more effective if you do this rather than speak it. So I think anything like that, and using nonverbal cues that you might agree with them in the beginning, that, you know, sometimes your excited voices get a bit loud and it can hurt my ears. So if that's happening, I'm going to show you by putting my hands over my ears. And when you see that, it means I need you to speak in a quieter voice. And you could try that. The five-year-old's going to get that quicker than the three-year-old. But again, if they're copying each other, there is some hope there. But you could do a nonverbal cue. They won't get it the first time, by the way. You're going to have to stick with it to get that. Mm-hmm. But I'm still going to go back to the most common cause for this is heightened excitement. And I think our kids are a little bit heightened and amplified in all kinds of feeling states at the moment. And it does stop. You know, excitement does wane about the world and life as our kids grow and take on some of our adult cynicism and things like that. So this is a window that this will happen. It won't be forever. I'm not going to give you a timeline because you might hold me to it. And you might have louder oriented kids. But, you know, you've probably got a little bit of time in this when everything feels so exciting that they've no other way of expressing it than in a loud, excited voice.
Mm. Could it be a little bit of competition in that, you know, each is trying to make themselves heard?
Oh, it definitely could be. And especially at 5 and 3 years old, you know, because they're within developmental reach of each other. And if they're both trying to tell you the one piece of news, it's going to be like a clatter bang wallop to talk over each other to get there first. So it might be about turn taking, and you tell me a bit, and now you tell me a bit, and you tell me what happened next. And you can do a turn taking stop start piece with that as well. But that would still be about excitement.
Yeah. Right. I found alcohol in my 15-year-old daughter's room. It was a bottle of vodka, which didn't come from our drinks press. She won't tell me where she got it, but given the only person she meets outside of the house is a particular friend from school to borrow a book or something, that I'm suspecting it's this friend. We are absolutely livid and have taken her phone from her indefinitely and have threatened to talk to the friend's parents. She confessed her group of friends all chat over Zoom and have a drink or two. We can't believe all this was happening while we were downstairs. Because of that, we don't let her use her laptop in her room anymore. I'm wondering, should we talk to the girl's parents? I know I would want to know what they are at as well. I think they should know what the group of girls appear to be doing in their rooms. I also don't know how to deal with this with my daughter. Is she too young for drinking safe information? My worry is she would think that this is a green light for further drinking. What does Joanna advise?
Oh my goodness, there's so much in here. Like this is not easy. So yeah, first of all, I want to start with you're livid. So taking action in that heightened state is not the best time. Wait until that, it won't come down to a cooling point, but let's get it to a simmer. Because when you're livid, you're going to be very reactive. You might do and say things. And even if you do go to the other parents, how you do that and the approach you take will be influenced by how you're feeling about this. And you're feeling betrayed, you're feeling disappointed, you're feeling shocked, and you're feeling livid. You know, you can't believe she was doing this upstairs while you were downstairs. That's a breach of trust. So I think you've got to sit first with yourselves, with each other, and just kind of really feel what's happened, own it, what has this brought up in me, and what you're going to do. The taking her phone from her indefinitely, I'm going to park that to one side of this because I'm not a fan of indefinite punishments in general or indefinite consequences. I think there has to be, this is what's happening. And again, you may have done that in a knee-jerk way, going, that's it. No phone forevermore. And again, when you cool down and have time to think about this and get some distance, you'll put a structure on that. And I would encourage you to, particularly at the moment when our teenagers are having such a tough time and they rely on their phones as a way of staying in contact with their peers, and they need that at the moment. So try to not cut off all lines of communication for her. You may decide as parents she's not having her phone for a period of time, but communicate that to her so she knows when that's ending. Now, you've threatened to talk to the friend's parents. I don't see that that's something you need to threaten to your own daughter. You're either going to do that as an adult parental decision, or you're not. That's not a consequence for your daughter, or something to threaten or intimidate or, you know, put that into her, because actually
it might be, though.
Well, it might have that effect, but it's not your daughter's call. Like, it's not her saying, oh, please don't do that, because if you don't do it, then I'll do X, Y, Z. That's not, I mean, you yeah. tell the parents or you don't. That's an adult choice. That isn't her anything she can contribute to. And putting it on her is just adding another layer of pressure about something she can't do anything about. Like, she really doesn't have a say in that.
Yeah.
And I think about the telling, you know, just to stick with that. Ultimately, whether you tell other parents is your call, okay? And I'd be really interested what people listening think about this. But my own instinct would be, you know, that it takes a village to raise a child is a phrase often used but rarely discussed. And I think if you approach this in a way of being helpful and supportive, but bear in mind that you've no control about how this will be received. Maybe yeah. a parent won't receive this well. Maybe they won't thank you for bringing this. Maybe they will be shamed. Maybe they will get defensive and say, well, that's your child, not mine. And you can't predict that. So be very clear about when you bring this to parents that if you're relying on them going, oh, gosh, thanks a million. You know, we're in this together. Let's get on the same page. You're not guaranteed that. OK, yeah.
Well, I mean, even this parent says she won't tell us where she got it from, but we assume she got it from her friend. Well, the friend's that's parents are going to assume exactly the same about their daughter.
And you know, that's a key part of this. I stay out of the assumptions. You don't know that. You absolutely don't know that. You might assume, or on the balance of probability or process of elimination, it's more likely, but that is anything but certain. Mm. And you definitely don't want to go to other parents and say, and it's your child who provided the alcohol. I think you want to inform them. And I think you should. My own gut is, yeah, look, this is, what if, let me put a what if there. What if they're drinking alone in their bedrooms? Okay, that's a worry, first of all. It's a worry that they're drinking at 15. It's yeah. a definite worry that they're doing it alone in their bedrooms, because anything could happen. And if something happens to one of these other kids and they pass out or they get sick or they whatever it might be, and you knew that they were drinking in their rooms, how will you feel about that then? So I think you could tell the other parent, particularly the one that you have a relationship with or that you know, but please approach that in a very calm, careful, considered way, and be very respectful about how you do it. I am letting you know something that has come to our attention, because if it was the other way around, I'd want to know. And I'm not telling you with any expectation or demand. I'm simply letting you know what you do with it is entirely up to you. You know, that you don't decide how this should play out. In terms of what you do with your own daughter, I'm always like, don't criticize her friends, criticize the behavior. And include her in that. It's not this friend is a problem or that friend is a problem. It's what you guys are doing is a problem. Okay, be very clear about that. I don't think she's too young for the information, given she's already drinking.
Yeah.
So I would absolutely talk to her about this, and in an open, calm, clear, considered way. Wait until you've calmed down, sit together and listen. You know, do a lot of listening. This isn't about sitting her down on one side of the table and you both on the other while you lecture, bombard. As soon as you go into lecture mode, she's not listening, and you need her to listen. This has to be a very open discussion to affect meaningful change. So be curious. Ask her about, you know, to talk about what's happened. Okay, look, here we are. Didn't imagine we'd be having this conversation. Tell us the story from your point of view. What has led to this? Ask her why she's interested in alcohol, but use open-ended questions. So wonder, don't say, are you interested in alcohol? You know, say, I wonder why you're curious and interested about this. Wonder if this is the first time, she's likely to tell you it is, by the way, but wonder if it's her first time drinking, and wonder where she got the alcohol. Don't decide it's the friend, but wonder about that. She may or may not want to share that with you. And again, don't drag it out of her. Just say that you're disappointed, that in order to move beyond this, you really need there to be open, honest communication. And that would include her owning up to where she got the alcohol. And reflect on what you've heard. Be empathic about it. You know, I'm going to make inferences here. She's likely to say, oh, we're bored. We've nothing to do. We can't meet each other. We just thought we'd do it. We didn't think it through any more than that. Empathize with, this is a hard time for you guys. You don't get to see each other. I understand that you're bored. Again, you're not condoning, by the way, you know, but you're just clarifying, I understand where you're coming from. And then you discuss calmly, but very honestly, the risks, negative effects, that it's illegal, how dangerous it is to do it in her room alone, and all of the concerns that you have. And talk as well about, you know, your expectations in a really clear way. You know, discuss what's going to happen and agree upon consequences. Be very clear there will be consequences, and agree with her what they should be, and explain why drinking, taking drugs affects teens differently to alcohol. And that might be that you go onto a website like DrinkAware and you arm yourself with lots of information about, you know, the teenage brain is developing at a time when actually putting something like alcohol in there is especially dangerous. And there are particular risks to teen drinking that is different to adult drinking. And talk to her about that openly. Talk about, you know, the effect it has on the body, on our skin, appearance, on concentration. Talk about the risks and how lowering of inhibitions it is. And just talk to her about alcohol in a very detailed way, but be clear about your boundaries and expectations. You're not allowed to drink. That's yeah. not okay. And we are saying a very clear no. We're educating you about alcohol and its risks, but within the context of you are not allowed to do this. And here are the consequences for breaking those family rules. So I think you have a lot to think about with this one. And given it caught you completely on the hop and you really didn't see it coming, give yourself a few days to really sit with it. Talk to each other about it, get on the same page and be clear about what messaging you're delivering. Because if you feel yourself getting really emotional, because again, you can't predict, she may give you lots of attitude, tons of defense, roll her eyes, you're blown this out of proportion, everybody does it. They're all attempts to kind of manage her own arousal in this. And again, just say, I hear what you're doing, I see it, but this is not okay. So we're going to sit here until we all get on the same page. It's up to you how long that takes.
I'll just read out three different reactions to this. Paddy says, I don't think banning everything is the best solution. Inevitably, it's the kids that are absolutely not allowed to drink or watch TV or have a phone or whatever else that end up being the most rebellious ones. Someone else says, the other parents probably know. When I was a kid, a load of my friends' parents wanted them to have a few drinks in the safety of their house, rather than out in the streets, though this seems to be upstairs in their bedrooms. And Maggie says, unfortunately, I'd imagine 15 is probably around the average age that Irish people start drinking in general. So they shouldn't overreact, but just make sure she's responsible about it. I don't know, is it possible for an average age?
It isn't really, but also the research does not back that up, you know, that... Actually, as parents, if we permit and allow our children, teenagers, to drink at home with us on the basis of, look, I'd rather they do it with me and it's safer. The research, you know, and there is considerable research in this area, would say your teenagers will still go beyond what you say is okay because they're wired to take risks. They are driven to push boundaries and crash through them. And actually, kids who are allowed to drink at home drink more when they're not with you. So again, they're generalizations. You'll always have an exception to the rule and maybe your child doesn't. But in general, that's not advice that we would give for that reason.
Right, we do have to take a commercial break. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. After that, a little boy who doesn't want to make his communion. 53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. Joanna Fortune is still with us. We did have one question from a mother who thinks her son is gay. He's 16. He hasn't said anything yet. And Joanna was saying just kind of, you know, send out the message that it's an open and tolerant house and very supportive LGBT people. Someone on Twitter suggests that one thing they could do is the two of them could start watching Schitt's Creek together. It's great crack. It leaves room for some wonderful open conversations. True. Plus, also,
very true.
That's a great show. Kim also on Twitter says once in a, what was the name of the book about feelings mentioned?
I mentioned two, but the one about feelings particular was How Are You Feeling Today? It's by Molly Potter. Lovely book, and you'll be able to get it quite easily. And the other one was My Mouth is a Volcano by Julia Cook. But that one was more about, you know, kids who talk over other kids, interrupt, speak out in class. You know, there's a lot of kids that would describe as well. And yes. Again, usually just because they're so excited to get their little bit out. But it talks about that.
My Mouth is a Volcano is a fantastic title for anything.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, next question is this. My son is due to make his first Holy Communion in May. He was christened as a Roman Catholic. In his class, there are a number of his classmates not making their communion this year. Myself and his dad are both Catholic, but would not go to Mass at all. Religion is not discussed in the house much, but my son is getting very upset about it and says he does not want to make his communion as he doesn't believe in God. He thinks it's impossible for the loaves and fishes to have been divided to feed so many. He thinks that it was impossible for St. Bridget to throw out a cloak so long. He has a great interest in science and has a logical mind for his age. He has issues with many other aspects of religion and is getting quite upset. I don't know how to explain these things to him. I've started blabbing the other day about his school is beside the church and they regularly have masses there as part of the school, so it's part of the community for the kids and they would all be celebrating their occasion together. I've no problem with him not doing his communion, but I'm not sure it's the best thing either. And I think this is a significant sentence, I think his grandparents would have a fit if he didn't make it.
I just think there's so much parental ambivalence in here, and that's a key part of this. You know, you say you've no problem with him not doing it, but you're not sure if that's the right thing. You've got to get sure. You've got to find your position on this and then go to him with it, because he's 8 years old and his questions are completely, you know, normal, healthy. He's curious. He's gone, but this doesn't make sense and this doesn't make sense. And he has one of those concrete, literal, scientific little brains, and you could appeal to it. I mean, you could clarify with him and explain, gosh, you're right. You know, it'd be weird to think that five fishes could feed that many people. But really, these stories are about messages. They're not intended to be literal. Maybe we could think about it in terms of global food distribution. It appeals to his scientific mind and say, you know, really, it's about making sure that if we pool our resources, everybody has enough. And you can extract the meaning of the stories and talk to him about that. I mean, you could definitely tell him these stories aren't intended to be literally interpreted. And I think that might even say, oh, OK, fair enough, because otherwise it is a hard sell for him. And I think, you know, you're talking about, look, you did christen him. You've sent him to a school that has a religious ethos. You yourselves grew up in Roman Catholic families, and you don't practice. So you've made a conscious choice that you don't practice and you don't talk about religion. I think if any of our children are going through religious ceremonies in school, we should bring some of that into our homes to talk about. I'm not telling everyone they need to go to mass, that's a choice, but that you should be talking about what they're learning in school so that they have somewhere to think it out loud, make sense of it, deepen their understanding of it. In terms of whether or not he makes his communion, you know, that's 100% your decision as a family. And while I acknowledge the grandparents will have an emotional response one way or the other, it is actually not their decision. It is yours as the parents. And I think you have to sit with him. But before you do, you really need to get sure about what your position is. Do you want him to do it and why? I mean, you could, if that's the case, you can say that and provide a boundary and some clarity by saying, look, you are going to make your communion and you're going to make your confirmation. And after that, you get to choose how you engage with religion, if that's what you're comfortable with. Or you say to him, you know, look, we've listened to it and it's something that we think that we should make a choice together. And if your choice is not to do it, we're OK with you not doing it. And you stick with that. But I think if you're kind of dipping into it's kind of OK, but it's not really OK and it might be OK, but I'm not sure if I'm OK with it, I think actually you've got to start with yourself, because he's also going to pick up on your uncertainty and say, well, what is this about at the end of the day? So I think as parents, make a call for you and your son, not with total deference to your own parents, and stick with it.
Yeah. As they say, several other kids in the class aren't making their communion, so he won't be totally left out by this. It's not like they won't be tutting at street corners because he's not making the communion.
Oh, absolutely. And you'll find that in every class group, there's going to be children who are not making it. And equally, he's going to see there are children in his class who are not doing it. So he knows it's an option not to do it. That's why it has to be something that around a parental boundary about, you know, you sent him to the school, you did christen him. Did you envisage that he would do these ceremonial pieces as well? You know, go through these sacraments with communion and confirmation through primary school. And then did you think, look, he'll make a choice because that's what we've chosen? And then you can sit and explain that to him. Look, we thought about this and we wanted to make sure you had choice. Mm-hmm. So it's our choice that you do these pieces. And after that, you can decide how you engage with religion. And if that's the truth, do that. But if you're actually saying, look, grandparents would go mad about this, we knew they'd go mad about the christening, so we did the christening and we didn't think beyond it, then now is the time to start thinking about it and what role religion is going to play in your family and in your son's life. Yeah. You've got a curious little guy who wants to understand this. So he's not just sailing through going, it's something everyone's doing, I'm grand, I'm going to do it, and I haven't thought about it. He is thinking about it. He is questioning. So it's kind of forcing this conversation a little bit earlier than maybe other families might have to deal with it. But I think you do owe it to him and each other to kind of sit and make a call on this one.
He's going to be nine, they say, in April. But it sounds like he's come to a conclusion. He says he doesn't believe in God. So if they tell him, go and make your communion, he has to say words he doesn't believe. Aren't they effectively telling him to tell a lie?
It's completely complicated. Exactly that. And that's why it has to be responded to. And he's going to be making confession as part of that, where, you know, we were told not to lie and to own our lies and all of that. So I think if he's saying, I don't believe in this because the stories don't make sense, that's maybe an inference I'm making. You know, he doesn't believe in God. Those stories don't add up. Talk about the stories in terms of their moral messaging and what they're trying to get us to think about and how they're trying to get us to reflect on our own behavior. Like, talk about the meaning in the stories, you know, and he'll understand that because he's also grown up with books about talking bunnies and bears. And he knows that bunnies don't really talk either. So, you know, he understands that stories can convey a message that isn't literal. So also relate that back, that it's not about a cloak that magically grew. It's not about fish that could suddenly feed five fish that could feed everybody. Talk to him about the meaning about it and get him to reflect on that, because that might be enough for him to go, oh, well, that makes way more sense. Now I get it. Or at least for him to reflect on it in a different way. But again, like, as parents, if you're not subscribe to this, you know, you'd have to go, gosh, I'd have to read those stories myself first too. Yes. Then, you know, do that. And I think that's what I mean when I say, you know, if our children are learning stuff and covering content in school and bringing home understandable questions about it to us, we need to understand what they're learning.
Yeah, indeed. And inevitably people are texting in to say, well, just tell him how much money he's going to make out of this, and that might...
I'm not going to go there.
That might change his mind. Joanna, thanks. Thanks a million.
Thanks, Sean.
Take care as ever. Joanna Fortune, there you are, listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk.
Moncrief on News Talk.